the Property Coaching and Wealth Creation Podcast, brought to you by property and business coach Daniel Latto. Join the conversation at www.daniellatto.co.uk. Remember to like and subscribe.
Hi, and welcome to the Property Coaching and Wealth Creation Podcast. And my guest today is a chap I've known a couple of times on in real life, and I've seen him on Facebook, and he's a very successful property investor. He comes by the name of Arsh Elahi, and he's a good all-round guy. Arsh, welcome to the podcast.
Morning, Daniel. Thank you for inviting me.
How are you doing today?
Other than struggling with a slight cough, which you might hear throughout the interview, which I apologise in advance for. Yeah, all good.
Fantastic. Now, you've been in property for quite some time, and you've had quite an interesting journey, I understand, where you did really well, and then you lost it, and then you brought it back.
Yes, that's very true. Property's never.
Can you just tell me a little bit more about that?
Property's never always been an easy journey for me. I've made a lot of money in property, also lost a lot of money in property. Now, when you're in property and you've lost a lot of money, it's very easy for you to just literally sit down and say, well, you know what, I've played around with property, it didn't really work for me, I'm going to try something else. But I was determined that it was going to work. We got hit just because a blip in the market, and I realised that I've got this talent to make money from property, and that's exactly what we do.
What have you done since that if there's another blip in the market that prevents the same thing from happening?
I've almost created like a recession-proof business now. I've learned what our issues were last time. We've learned from the mistakes, and we won't be making those mistakes again. I think what happened last time, we just got carried away with the market. We bought far too much piece of land. We were sitting on a lot of land. We had a lot of developments that were work in progress. And the biggest lesson that we learned is to make sure that our incomings are far greater than our outgoings, which was the other way around prior to the crash.
Of course. And it gives you that buffer, doesn't it? So that if it hits the fan, then it's fine. You've got the cash sat there ready, waiting for it.
Exactly.
What's interesting is you say property's not been an easy journey for you. And I think there's an idea that's given by those people on stage that say, just do this, this and this and you'll have this success. And we both know that actually it's a lot harder than that. And there's an assumption that being in property should be easy. And I don't think that assumption's right at all. It's blooming hard work.
It is blooming hard work. Yeah, I completely agree.
It really is. And you have to overcome obstacles that you've never had to overcome in the past. You know, tenants not paying for all sorts of reasons. Doing viewings where you open the door and the man is like collapsed behind the door and you have to push him out of the way to get in, and there's beer cans all over the floor and you're just about to do a viewing and it's like, okay, I've never had that before. And I mean, that's a nice easy one. We've had far worse than that, you know, as a property investor, you've seen all sorts.
It is. But
the key for me personally has been that persistence in never giving up. And every time I've had an issue that's been big, you know, really big, I've looked at that and gone, well, what's the alternative? And the alternative was to really go get a job. And I really didn't want to go get a job. And I'm sure that's the last thing you want to do. And you really enjoy what you do now.
Yeah, there's some days that I wish I had a 9-to-5, Monday to Friday 9-to-5. But other than that, no. But with property, sometimes it really kicks you and it can kick you down. But the biggest thing is to have the willpower to literally just think, well, it's only one bad day, and you start moving on.
So in NLP terms, we'd call that a reframe, where you're just reframing it to, yeah, this has happened, but you know what, it's just a one-off. And often when that one bad thing happens, for me, it's been like DSS not paying their rent, or they've cancelled their DSS payment but refused to move out. That's a real, you know, I've had a couple of those, and it's a real pain when it happens. But actually, you're allowing someone who's on benefits to make your decision as to whether you want to be in property anymore. And that's a crazy way to form a decision on that basis, I find.
Yeah, I mean, so, my portfolio, I know this is going to sound absolutely crazy. Well, we've got well in excess of 500 tenants now.
Yeah.
And I would say, just looking at this yesterday, we're approximately 98 or 99% of them are on benefits. Now, I know that that may not be flavour of the month for a lot of people listening to the podcast. But if I was to break it down in terms of numbers, facts and figures, it actually does make financial sense. And providing that you structure it correctly and systemize it correctly, can actually provide you with a very good recession-proof business.
Now, that's the point, isn't it? There's two areas, two words that you said there. The first one was structure, and the second one was systems. Now, a percentage of my portfolio is DSS, but it's very, very small. And because it's very, very small, I don't allocate enough time to actually implementing systems with which to deal with DSS specifically. Whereas you're in total reverse, because 99% of them are DSS. Obviously, it makes perfect sense to systemize the whole lot, to understand fully how that DSS system works with the local councils, for example. Because I haven't got a clue, you know, other than I know that I can get the tenant to sign a sheet of paper that will enable the council to make an emergency payment, otherwise we're guilty of maladministration. For example, that's one thing that I know. But you've probably got systems for everything for dealing with DSS.
Yeah, well, I've been brought up around, well, when I say brought up, from the moment I was able to walk, I've known nothing else other than to be a landlord or be in business. And that all stems back to my father. God rest his soul. He passed away, unfortunately, in March this year. So my father, he was quite an innovative man, because when I was approximately 4 or 5, when other kids were out in the road playing football with their mates or around the park, etc., I would be with him working. Either, you know, walking around properties, collecting rent, you know, emptying those 50p meter machines that were for the electric. It was a lot shorter distance for me to go to the meter than it was for him. So property was a part-time thing for my father, because his actual first real love was running an engineering company. He was a precision engineer, and back in the day, he had large contracts with companies like Caterpillar, the Lex Group. So they were multi-million pound businesses.
I find it really interesting that at sort of age 4 or 5, you're out with your dad and you're learning property. Yep. My children now are 7 and 10, and they come out with me and do viewings and move tenants in and so on.
Believe it or not, my daughter's 2, and I take her out with me.
Brilliant. There's an education right there. And Donald Trump was the same. He went out with his dad when he was younger, and that's how he learned his business too. I've sat down with my 2 and drawn a house and go, okay, this costs me £300 a month in costs, but this, and I draw a stick man or woman, and that person there, that they pay £500, so that's how much is it profit? £200, okay. And if I need £2,000 a month to live, how many houses do I need? And we'll calculate it, 10 houses, great. So what would you prefer to do? Would you rather buy 10 houses, or would you prefer to work in a job? We call it 9 to 5, but it's more like 8 till 6, 6:30, isn't it? Because you've got to get there.
Yeah.
And just, I'm trying to indoctrinate my children into a different way of life rather than the indoctrination they're currently receiving from everyone else, including the media, school, their mother, for example. Because I think that different form of education is really, really important. If they want to be successful and to understand that they can do whatever they want, as long as they can choose what they want and they plan it, which is pretty much what you're doing as well.
Yeah.
And I love the fact that you're taking your daughter out. And even at 2, there's just like a sponge anyway. I mean, my latest daughter's 8 months old now, and she's just like an absolute sponge in terms of taking things in. And we don't know it because we can't see it, but we really are. Between 0 and 7 is what's called your imprint period.
Yeah.
And it's where all your values are imprinted. And to some extent, your belief systems are imprinted on the brain as well. And if you can indoctrinate them, and I use that word on purpose, by the way, Ash, indoctrinate.
Okay. Because
they are being indoctrinated right now, whether you like it or not, through society, media, school. And so my job is to make sure that I get my indoctrination on them rather than the idea that you go out and work, you know, 9 to 5 until you die, basically, and you get into debt and that sort of thing. So how old were you when you got your first property then?
Right. There's 2 sides to this story, because the first side was is that when I left university, which I think was in the year 2000, graduated from the University of Gloucestershire, which my campus was based in Cheltenham, which is a nice part of the world. When I left university, I had 2 options. Now, my first, I'm going to be completely honest, and my first passion was music. Right. I've been DJing across the world since I was 16 years old, and I still do to this date. I've actually got a gig this weekend, which I'm quite looking forward to. It gives me that form of release. So
can I just clarify, this isn't like a Barry's Disco, is it?
No, not at all. So this is full on. Look, I've played gigs, you know, to festivals where you've got fields of 2,000 plus.
That's awesome.
So, you know, it's a great feeling, but more importantly, it gives, you know, the reason why I really love it, it gives me a release when I'm listening to music. I can lose myself and, yeah, you know, I can get that time for myself, and it all brings it back into perspective for me. Yep. So, so my first passion was music. I've been DJing around the world since I was 16. And then when I left university in the year 2000, I sat down with my dad and I said, okay, here's my options. One of the options was that I was going to go around the world and start DJing again. And, you know, my dad said to me, he goes, that's great. And he goes, you've got to look at two things. You've got to look at either short term or you've got to look at the long term. Now, DJing is great and you're going to have a great life DJing. You're going to go around, you're going to meet loads of people and it's going to be fantastic living. But where does that see you in the long term? And I looked at it at that point. He goes, you can still DJ. You could probably still DJ on the weekends if you stayed local. But how about if you get involved with me? And now I'm one of six siblings. So my mom and dad had six kids. And in the property business already at that time were two other brothers. They're both older. I'm the youngest of the six. So there's already two brothers in there, and they had started up almost like a property development company. So how it was structured is my father would look after his engineering company. My two brothers, Aki and Aj, would look after the development company. And then I would go on to look after my father's small property portfolio. Now, my father's portfolio was consisted of approximately, I think it's about 20 properties. So it's not a lot in comparison to today's terms. But a lot of the properties were already converted into HMOs. And it's a model that I already knew because, like I said, I'd grown up since the age of four walking around these properties. So I knew these properties like the back of my hand. And what I really started to do, I started to do a stress test on the portfolio to see whether was it making money, was it not making money, could we look to generate some further income from it, what were we getting with regards to voids and bad debt, and really see where our problems were. That's the aim of it, to see how we could improve it. And what I found is that at the time, I think we had a 50-50 split of worker professionals and benefits. What I found is that because of the way my father had structured it, he was letting tenants live there for a rent, working and charging them a rent in arrears, so a month in arrears. I found that really strange. To people on benefits, that wouldn't be the norm because the council would pay rent in arrears, which I completely understood. And I didn't really understand why he was allowing workers to live in the property for a month and then pay for that month. And the analogy that I use today is that you wouldn't go to a supermarket like Asda, pick up a can of beans and say, do you mind if I eat this and come and pay you in a month?
Yeah, of course.
It would never happen. And so I said to my dad, I said, this is what we're going to do. We're going to restructure it to a point now where I'm comfortable with it, where everyone's paying in advance unless you're on benefits, because the council back then were paying direct to the landlord. And that was guaranteed. So I was happy with that. And we found that a lot of the bad debt and the voids were coming from workers, where they would live in the property for the month. Then when it came to the first of the month, they think, well, we've got two options. So I can either pay the landlord or I can run off knowing that I've just lived in a property rent free for that month.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What we found is that they were running off. We had a good few that would stay. But so what I said to my dad, I said, what we're going to do, we're going to structure it now because we've got a good clientele with the benefits market. Every professional that leaves, we're going to now replace it with a benefit tenant. And he looked at me quite strangely. And he goes, are you sure about that? Because we don't want to put all our eggs in one basket. And I said, well, when you look at it from a point of view, the government have been paying people to live in this country, providing that unemployed since day dot. Now, unless that ever changes, which I doubt will ever happen, because we'll have approximately 6 million people in limbo, there'll always be a guaranteed income. So he got around to my way of thinking. I said, we'll test it, see how you think. Okay. And it worked fantastically well. And we went from having voids of like 25% and bad debt, and say 20%, up to occupancy rates of 98, 99%, 100% rent collection.
Brilliant.
And that was bad systemizing. So that was his portfolio. Getting involved into property, actually owning property, was when I was actually buying the development sites with my two brothers. And I bought my first buy to let, believe it or not, quite late on. I think it was 2004, 2005.
Okay.
So, that was it. But at that point, we only decided to keep them as single lets, not do anything creative with them like HMOs or anything like that.
And how did you accelerate the purchasing of properties up from like 2004-ish up to now?
Wow. Okay. Now, back then, as you know, there were companies out there like Mortgage Express.
Yep.
That were offering same-day refinance. And I actually run, and I've still got this business. It's called We Buy Properties Fast. And now, Daniel, if I was to ask you what we do, you'd like to think that the name says it all, We Buy Properties Fast. So we went out on a massive marketing campaign. So we went on a West Midlands region marketing campaign, and our budget for the month, we were spending between £100,000 and £150,000 on marketing.
Wow. That's phenomenal.
We were buying at that time, we were offering at that point between 70 and 75% below market, 70 to 75% of market value.
Yeah.
We were buying approximately 30 properties a month.
Wow. That's amazing. And obviously, Ben, things changed, didn't they, when MX pulled out of that?
Yeah. But believe it or not, we had a really good relationship with both Lloyds and RBS. RBS still allowed us to do it up until 2011.
Brilliant.
So because we had quite a strong cash flow position with my father's portfolio.
Yeah.
And they'd seen the income increase rapidly from when I took it on. Providing that we were purchasing, and after the crash, we were no longer purchasing at 70 to 75%. We were now purchasing at between 50 and 55%.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of equity in the portfolio. And RBS were happy with the levels that we were buying at. They were happy knowing that there was still a large amount of equity and we weren't gearing up to 80 or 85%. We were only pulling out the kind of money that we were putting in.
Yeah.
So in that respect, that's what allowed us to buy our properties very quickly. And more importantly, I put all our portfolio on to capital repayment from day one.
Yeah. I think there's been a bit of a problem, hasn't it? And people, you know, you can take out, or you could use to take out up to 85% of the property's value. And so you did.
Yeah.
And I was guilty of that. I went out and bought Porsches and Ferraris and penthouse flat.
Yeah. So no, luckily I didn't do that because the way that I saw it is that you're going to have to pay that money back. That money is still expensive money when you work on the basis that let's just say that you bought the property at 75%. So you had 10% and then you geared it up to 85%. You pull that 10%. And now let's just say on the basis that it was a £100,000 purchase, you could potentially pull out 10 grand, which is just cash for you to enjoy. Yes, it's tax free. But then from that point, you know, unless you use the money wisely, it could actually be quite expensive. And I know there's lots of people that used it to their advantage. And a very good friend of mine, Jim Halliburton, who's known as the HMO Daddy, who I speak to probably every day, if not every other day, because we're in the same location. He used that money really well because he went out and purchased a lot of property very quickly.
We interviewed Jim last week, and to talk to Jim about what he did, he set himself a target of 50 properties in 50 weeks, which he would hit, and that's just phenomenal. And his advice actually was not to do it. If anyone is thinking about that, my advice is don't. Because it's a real headache buying 50. As I'm sure you know, if you're buying 30 a month, you know, the logistics of that is quite difficult.
It is. I mean, as of 30, our strategy was to keep half and buy half, keep half and trade half. So we were trading properties. So that gave us cash flow, which then allowed us to go off and buy the others. So, you know, it was a really, really good time.
So that's interesting as well, because there's a book called No Money Down by someone whose name escapes me right now. I'm sure it'll come back to me. But he always said, never sell. Never, ever, ever sell. And then he went bust.
Yeah.
He's a very well-known guy. He's on the circuit still, and he's got all his finances back now. But I don't think there are any absolutes in property. You do as the market dictates, and you have to adapt with the market. So the market has changed for you with DSS because of the benefit caps. Has that affected your business much?
Me and my portfolio personally, no.
Okay.
Just purely because a lot of the properties that we've got, we've chopped up into small units. So yeah. I recently bought a property out of auction, spent $115,000, probably spent slightly too much because my ego got the better of me that day.
Okay.
is another landlord that owns a property on the street, and I already own approximately on that road, I already own a 100-bed HMO.
Yeah.
Which is lots of properties which are converting into smaller units. And then also there's a property that came up over the road, and I thought it just makes logical sense for me to own it. And yeah. I saw another landlord who owns one or two on that street, and he started a slight bidding war against me. So I probably paid about 15,000-20,000 over what I would have normally paid. But yeah. saying that, on a £115,000 purchase, I'm now in the process of doing a £60,000 refurb project on it. So it's going to owe me approximately 175 plus some fees, so about 180. And on that basis, it's going to be returning me £700 a week, which is just over £35,000 a year.
Amazing. And that's after mortgage interest has been deducted and all the other costs like electricity and so on.
I don't believe in all-inclusive HMOs, so this is where I'm completely different to probably every yeah. other HMO investor in the country. I like knowing that all the bills are paid by the tenants, whether that's right or wrong, still yet to be decided, but I get away with it. When I say get away with it, I've never had a tenant complain saying that they can't afford to live in the property.
Yeah, no, I think that's the right way of doing it. How do you manage that? Do you install like another ring mains in that particular bedroom, and then they have a token meter?
Yeah, so what I do is that I go through quite an extensive refurb actually, where we bring in 3-phase electricity supply.
Yeah.
So that every room's now got their own electric meter with the energy supplier, not with me. So I don't sell anyone tokens. I don't want to sell anyone tokens. I don't want to be that landlord where they call me at 8 o'clock in the evening whilst they're watching Emmerdale and their TV cuts out because they've just run out of tokens. I don't want to have to leave the house at 8 o'clock in the evening to go and sell them tokens.
And so in order to change that, what's the sort of costs per room, you know, on, say, a 5 or 6-bed HMO, although I'm guessing you do much bigger HMOs than that, but what's the average, what does that average out?
On an average 6-bed HMO, the reason why this one's cost me so much is that we've taken it literally back to bare brick, we've stripped it, we've taken off the roof, put a brand new roof on, so absolutely everything. But on a normal HMO, I'd work on the basis of between $5,000 and $7,000 a room. So on a 6-bed, say between $30,000 and $35,000.
Got it. So for people listening and they're like, oh my gosh, $5,000 to $7,000 per room, they would never even consider doing that. But the returns that you're getting speak for themselves because you're going to earn £35,000 a year profit.
Exactly. And not only that, it's that it's a hassle-free model. Like now I'm a firm believer that anyone, and I've been shot down so many times for saying this statement, and I'll continue to say it for as long as I continue to go, is that HMOs, where it's all inclusive, I believe that a landlord is never fully in control of that HMO, because you're never in control of what the tenants are doing in that property. You can have the gas and you can restrict it so it comes on, let's say, 2 or 3 times a day. But then you don't know what's going on in their room. They could have 2 kilowatt fan heaters running in their room. And by law, you can't enter that property to see what's running. And it's a lot cheaper to run the gas than it would be if 6 tenants were to have 2 kilowatt panel heaters or 2 kilowatt fan heaters running in their rooms.
And just to clarify, you can't go into that room. You can go into the property, just not that specific room.
Yes, you can go into a property into communal areas, but you can't go into the rooms unless you give 24 hours notice. But even then, it gives your tenants, depends on how savvy they are, 24 hours to remove any form of evidence.
And to be honest, they can always reject that anyway because they're entitled to quiet peace and enjoyment.
Indeed, indeed.
So. I only point this out for podcast listeners that think they can enter into someone's house or room. Because a lot of people are taught from a letting agent, oh, you can just walk in. And, well, you can, but you'll go to prison for it.
Indeed.
Breaking the law.
Indeed. So, you know, the last thing you want to do is be seen in court for something like illegal, unlawful eviction or anything like that. Because it's, you know, providing that you follow the law to a T, you shouldn't have any issue as a landlord.
And it's one of my bugbears as well, in that people, they buy properties, they rent them out, and then they do nothing in terms of their education for understanding how to run a tenancy. So I've done the How to Be a Landlord course twice now, because I need to know about Section 8s and Section 21s and what you can do to evict them and what you can't do. Can you change locks? Can you not? You've got to know that information, because if you get that stuff wrong, it's really, you know, the course is £90.
Yeah.
But to not do that is, you're talking several thousands.
Indeed.
Minimum, you know. Okay, so in terms of the number of properties that you manage now, what sort of systems have you got in place in order to do that? Because you've got quite a few businesses all surrounding property.
Yeah, so we've got my own property portfolio. Now, I've also, on the back of that, in 2008, when the government decided to change its strategy where now all tenants would be paid direct, we actually became an accidental letting agency. Where we got lots of landlords who are also friends of ours, came to us and said, well, you know, tenants are now running off with their money. What can we do? So we started managing their properties for them. And then now that's managing well in excess of 300 properties. And on the strength of that, we've opened a branch in Liverpool, and we're in the process of franchising it so that we're opening more offices across the country.
Love it.
So in that respect, yeah, so the Wolverhampton office manages approximately 300 properties, but we're not just a standard letting agency. We work on a net rent model where we don't just run around for 10%. Because I don't think the agents that run around for 10% make a lot of money. They'll make some, but not a lot. We work on the basis that, you know, any commission achieved over a certain amount of rent is now deemed as our commission.
That's great. Love that as an idea. I think that's wonderful. What's the URL for your letting agent if people want to take a look at that?
Yeah, it's www.rent-me-now.co.uk. If you were to ask me whether I'd name the company differently now, thinking about it possibly, because Rent Me Now doesn't really, it could go into many different ways and forms.
Yep.
So, no, it's good. You know, so we've got the agency. And then I run a property trust.
Just about the company name, Arsh. There's always two ways to name a company. The first way is to do what it says on the tin.
Yeah.
The second way is to build a brand.
Yeah.
So I had a Porsche hire company called Hire My Porsche. Guess what we did? We hired Porsches out. And it was I had a 911 for my sins. It was a lovely car, but we rented it out because, you know, the whole asset versus liability. I didn't want a liability. How do we turn it from a liability to an asset? We generate cash that pays for the Porsche. So we were cash positive on that business, which was awesome. I get to drive it myself, and then we rent it out, and we actually make money on that, which is really cool. So, and then the lettings agency was the Think Tank Group, which was sold a couple of years ago. It no longer exists now. But once you've heard that name, you never forget it. And so that's the branding type. So, I, you know, there's nothing wrong with Rent Me Now. It doesn't say that it's houses. It could be Porsches or speedboats. But other than that, it's fine.
Yeah,
it does the job.
The logo that we've got indicates that it's a house because we've got a roof.
Yes.
So yeah. So in that respect, I think we've kind of got that covered. But yeah, it's good.
Right.
The agency is, for me, it was just another way of making money from old rope. We already had the skills. All we had to do was implement the systems to make it into a business. And now my involvement in that business is very limited. I actually go out and do more so the business strategy and the business creation, should I say.
As you should do. Too many business owners get stuck into, because they enjoy that particular angle, so they just go and do that all the time, and it really really limits their growth.
Yeah. So, I mean, okay. I don't look off. Well, all I do is I just watch over to see if there's any sticky points, that's where I get involved. But other than that, I have no day-to-day involvement in the letting agency. The only thing that I'm guilty of is that... I am very power hungry about my own personal portfolio, because the way that I see that is that's the bread and butter of all things that we do. You know, I want to make sure that we've got such a strong rent roll. I never want to see that come down. So I am very on the ball when it comes to my own portfolio. I like to know who's in our property, when, where, why. How much to pay, when they're next due, etc. So I keep a very close eye on my portfolio, to the point that at some point I even interview my own tenants. Because, you know, with all due respect, I wrote an article in this month's YPN magazine, Your Property Network, about, yep, you know, who's best to manage your properties. And I've seen so many, because I go up and down the country speaking at different networking events, I see so many landlords saying that they've got voids. One landlady that I know who's now a mentee of mine, she's had a void in one room for 14 weeks. Now, the, wow, rent, the rent on that room is £100 a week, so they've lost £1,400. That would never happen in my portfolio, never, ever. The maximum a day a room's allowed to be vacant for is approximately 3, maybe 5 days.
Yeah. Yep.
After that, I want to know why.
I also don't have an issue with you being so strict on the management of your own portfolio. I've done it where I've taken my eye off the ball and then you come back 6 weeks later and stuff is empty and you're like, what's going on? I think it's your responsibility to ensure that your properties are full. It's not the letting agent necessarily, although they have a responsibility, but the ultimate responsibility is always the landlord. And I think too many landlords, one, they're not very good at letting it out, but two, they don't want to pay the letting agent fees. And so they're stuck in this circle. But I'd rather them pass it over to a letting agent, but then they keep an eye on the letting agent and keep them on the toes until it's rented out.
Yeah.
But it is always your responsibility to make sure that your portfolio is rented out. It's nobody else's.
It's true. And I can sit here with both hats and as you could, Daniel, is that, yeah, you, as a letting agent, you know, believe it or not, a lot of letting agents are not saying that we do, but a lot of letting agents will try and let properties that produce the highest fee first. Mm. And so we get, you know, Wolverhampton, we get so many landlords that try and negotiate on our fees and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And, you know, naturally you'll take their property on, but it may not be at the top of the pecking order.
Yeah.
Because there are other landlords that are willing to pay the fee and are willing to pay us for what we're worth. So, yep, you know, in that respect, you know, letting agents to a point could be to agree to blame. It could also be that she just hasn't chose. And when I looked at it, I just didn't think the letting agent had the pedigree or the ingredients to manage the property.
Got it. Now, you've got a book out, I understand.
Yes. Recently.
Tell me a little bit about the book.
Launched, it was launched in memory of my father, which is launched on Father's Day in 2015. Right. And what it is, it's a book called Boom, Bust and Back Again, which is, it's not biography. What it is, it's a book that gives you lessons, what to do, what not to do in property. Now, in there, I don't just buy property and I don't just keep them as a portfolio. I do a number of things. So there's one of the things that I do is that we buy and we trade on. There's others that we buy, we do up and we sell on. There's others that I'm still continuing to buy and keep from our portfolio. But any point in our journey, I'm approximately buying between 10 and 15 properties. So we've always got acquisitions going on. We've always got sales going on. Because I think that in property, you can't just stick to one strategy. If you stick to one strategy, you could be very limited in what you do. Now, luckily, I'm fortunate in a position where we've got the cash flow to be able to do that. But it's taken me a number of years to get here. So the book talks about all that. It talks about HMOs. It talks about the LHA strategy, the single let strategy, how we manage to maximise our return and how we manage to systemise it into a business where other people have predominantly said that the market won't work.
Yeah.
And we talk about flipping deals, we talk about the developments that we've done. More importantly, we talk about how we lost money, which is quite a sore point because, you know, we lost potentially the best part of £8 million worth of personal wealth.
Yeah.
So that's a bitter. And, you know, when you're writing about it, it brings back all those memories.
Oh, yeah.
It brings all those memories back, you know, to the point where I couldn't afford a haircut, to a point that we had to literally strip back because I was at a point where we had all the flash cars. We could do anything that we wanted to do financially. And then all of a sudden, it was stripped out.
Yeah.
So we had to, and the beauty of it is that we went back, we reassessed our situation. We went back to grassroots.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, one of the people involved in the original business no longer is in the business. I think he just found it too hard and too much of a bitter pill to swallow. And he went his separate ways. So, you know, it's affected us more than financially, but also personally as well.
Mm-hmm. Which you went through what I call the Death Star moment. So the Death Star moment is, you know, in Star Wars where Luke blows up the Death Star.
I've got to admit here, I've never watched the Star Wars.
Let me tell you briefly. I'll summarise the story. Very briefly. So Luke Skywalker is the hero, and he has to blow up a space station. So he blows up the space station, and for most people, they reach a point where that's the best thing that they could ever do, because it's amazing. I mean, who blows up a space station, right? So he does that, and that's his Death Star moment, because you think, how can I top that? And ultimately, through the remainder of the films, he actually goes and destroys the Empire, the evil Empire that built the space station in the first place. But most people get to that Death Star moment where they've done that and then rest on that laurel for the rest of their life.
Yes.
And then nothing since then ever compares to that. And that's why I call it the Death Star moment. So that Luke, he goes through the story and ends up wiping out the Empire. And that's the same for you as well. You hit your Death Star moment and then things took a turn and then you've brought it back.
Yes.
Awesome. Now, if you had to start again, how would you do it and what would you do?
I mean, there's so many ways of making money and property. Would I buy my own portfolio again? Perhaps.
Do you know what I think the problem for most people is, Arsh?
Yeah.
Most people, they need certainty. So, yeah, they could go to an auction like you have, they could buy a house, they could spend 50 on it, but they've got no guarantees as to whether they're going to have the same level of success as that you will. So it's, I think for people listening, sometimes it can be frustrating because they're like, well, it's all right for him because he knows what he's doing. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does, completely.
So with that in mind, how do you know for sure that when you buy a house that you're going to spend 10 on it, that it's going to be worth 30 more?
Because for me, it's my experience, because in that respect, I've bought a two-bed mid-terrace property in a part of Wolverhampton that people possibly wouldn't buy. Yeah. And I bought it for £40,000, believe it or not. We spent approximately £20,000 on a refurb. And that now, in theory, the market value for that property should be worth circa around £100,000. But on its commercial valuation, providing that property is generating £20,000 a year in rental income,
yeah,
we've had that valued at £200,000 on its commercial valuation.
And so the commercial valuation is 10 times the rent income.
Yeah, that's what we're currently getting in Wolverhampton. We've got good surveyors on board who are allocated by Lloyds, and they understand our model extremely well.
So you bought for 40, spent 20, so that's 60. And then you got, was it a 70% loan to value at the £200,000?
No. Well, all I did, I just took out my 60. I never take out more than what we've spent on it.
Perfect. And that in there is what we were talking about before, about people overextending themselves. And that's also the thing that makes you recession-proof for the next bump in the road.
Indeed. So worst-case scenario, if something ever happened, I've got that buffer or that equity in that portfolio that I can call upon.
And so what's the, after all your expenses, what's the profit on that on each year?
So it produces, so more, four rooms generating £100 a week, which is £400 a week, times that by 52. So it's £20,800 a year. I think my, we've got lending on that £60,000, probably a lot less than that now because that was taken out about 4 years ago. So, mortgage on that, I think is about £300, maybe £400 a month.
Okay. So, and that's repayment.
Yeah. That's on capital repayment. And so on that basis, you know, so that's 4,800. So I'm still clearing 15,000 from that property.
Brilliant. See, whenever we do these interviews, I always want to get into the nitty gritty about what the numbers look like.
Yeah.
And it's always interesting that people, off the top of your head, like maths has never been my strong point, okay? But I can work these numbers through off the top of my head because I've done them about a million times, like you have clearly, right?
Yeah.
Because you sat with your piece of paper, especially when you first got started. Boy, I literally did them a million times because 6 years it took me to buy my first house. I was 26 at the time and I'd been wanting to do it for 6 years and everyone said, don't do it. We all know people where it's gone wrong. But stuff does go wrong, but you get over that. And that's, you know, just part of the journey, isn't
Indeed.
It? Stuff will continue to go wrong and you get better at dealing with that and you have better strategies that prevent things from going wrong. For example, you know, you went from boom to bust and back again. Because of the learnings that you got from going bust in the first place. You now know what not to do, which has improved your business over time.
Indeed, yes.
So if you had to start again, give me two ways in which you would do it, starting with very little money if you can.
Believe it or not, I'm going through this journey now because I've taken on some mentees and I've taken on some mentees where I haven't actually got any money.
Oh, yep, okay.
But I think they've got the great ability to learn and the desire to do well. So what we're doing, we're currently looking at two different strategies. We're looking at the sourcing strategy, and we're also looking at the rent-to-rent strategy. Now, rent-to-rent, for those that don't know, is where you literally rent a property off someone or manage it for a decent period of time. I try and get approximately a seven-year term.
Yep.
And you maximise on the return there. So you pay your landlord the rent agreed, and then you try and multi-let the property, and you pull it out. But I wouldn't suggest that someone does that long term. Now, what I'm doing in the process at the moment is building a large portfolio of those and selling that as a business.
Yeah.
Because it still is a commodity that can be sold. Not many people know that. So in that respect, you know, because you can potentially make, you know, best part of 100,000, et cetera, from that sale. I sold one for a person in London, and we produce £120,000 purchase on that. So, and then he's used that money now to go off and buy properties. So, he's buying them around the Midlands where the average deposit is 25,000. So potentially that will buy him 4/5 properties, and then he'll go off and do the rent-to-rent strategy again. So it's a continuous cycle. On the sourcing side, it's very easy to source a property, to get in direct and to get into direct contact with motivated vendors. And then, you know, potentially whether you decide to sell them on for a profit, and that could be anywhere from as little as £30, depending on the level of detail that you got, right up to £40,000. I'm currently trading one at the moment where we've sourced it direct from the vendor. We've agreed £70. We've sold it for £110 the same day.
Brilliant. And so you take an option out on that at £70?
Correct.
Okay. And so just explain how you do that. So obviously, I mean, it's a throwaway line for me. It's like, oh, you've taken an option out. I get that. Just explain in 5 sentences or less how you take an option out on property, very, very briefly.
Okay. So you meet the vendor. You agree the price. You get them to sign something to a form of exclusivity. I try and get 60 days or more. I try and find a purchaser. And depending on the level of value in the centre, we either do a standard commission structure basis sale, where the vendor or the purchaser pays us our commission, which in this one would be 40,000, or we do a back-to-back transaction.
Yeah. Perfect. And how do you source? Give me your top two best methods for you, and it's different for everybody, but what are your two best methods for sourcing these type of deals direct to vendor?
Believe it or not, social media.
Social media, wow. So for me, it's been leaflets, and it's always been leaflets for the last 10, 15 years.
Yeah, we've done leaflets, and you know, the one thing that we find is that with leaflets is you just never know when it's going to be picked up, how it's going to be picked up. Whereas on social media, I get a lot of deals from property sources or other property sources around the country, but the beauty of it is that a lot of them don't see the angle that I see.
Mm. So just interestingly, it's not that you're going direct to vendor, but you're going through a property sourcer who is direct to vendor, and then you're just purchasing the deal for, say, £2,000 as a commission there.
Correct. Possibly.
Interestingly.
Yeah, so there's lots of ways to skin the cat there, but yeah.
Yeah. And I find it interesting as well, because when Donald Trump walks down the street and when I walk down the street, we both see completely different things.
Yes.
And when you walk down the same street, you see something else entirely.
Yes, completely.
When a homeless person walks down the street, they're looking for places to sleep, you know?
Yeah.
And it's interesting that wherever your focus goes will determine your results in life. And so many people are focusing on not having enough money. Well, it's all right for Ash, but I don't know how to do rent to rent. And so they don't do it. Instead of finding out how to do it, or even asking, well, how could I do a rent to rent? What would be the best question for me to ask a vendor to ask them to do it? And you might not get it right the first time, but the 50th time, you're probably getting it right.
You will.
Most people don't get past the first time. Go, oh, I did that, and it didn't work. Well, how many times have you done it? Once. Oh, okay. How many times did you learn to walk or ride a bike or do anything, for goodness sake, you know?
Very true.
Okay, so social media is one. What's the second best way for you to source?
Second, believe it or not, it's just my shop front. I've got, because I'm one of the very few people across the country who have set up an office. I was one of the first in the Midlands anyway, in I think it's 2004, set up a high street presence in Wolverhampton. And what separated me apart from my competitors, who were all advertising in the back of paper, I could say to my any of the vendors, saying, well, I'll tell you what, you've got two options. You can either go with that company that's advertising the back of paper, call Jeff or call John. But what happens is that if they, because I predominantly say that they won't be buying your property, they'll predominantly be looking to source your property on.
Yep.
And if they can't sell their property, guess what? They're going to stop calling you and you're not going to be able, every time you try and call them, they'll just reject your call. Whereas I can't do that. I've got high street shop presence. And so anytime you want to come and see me, the doors will always be open. And that brought so much confidence to vendors. That's where we made most of our leads. And that's still where we get a lot of leads. We get a lot of walk-ins every day.
Brilliant. So just as we're coming up to the end of the interview, what's next for you, do you think, after this?
Well, my goal is that I'm going to retire at 45. That's already in place. The goal's already...
And what are you going to do after 45? Because I hear this a lot, I'm going to retire. I retired when I was 29, and I was bored for 18 months, and I went and started a letting agency. I was that bored. That's how bored you can get. And a friend of mine said, oh, well, I'll just play golf. And I said, yeah, but who with? And usually it's men talking about the prostrate at 65, you know?
Yeah.
So what would you do after 45 when you say you retire?
I don't think I think I'll retire from property. When I say property, I mean that I'll possibly sell up or I'll do something with the properties that I own, which will give me a nicer lifestyle. And then I'll probably just keep some of the other businesses, and because my involvement in them are very limited anyway. For me, it would just be a management role. And my wife always says that she'll see me going into some form of lecturing.
Okay.
So she said that I'd be a great college lecturer. I'm not sure if I want to do that, but some form of consultancy, I think, would be good.
I think the college thing, you're restrained by other people's belief systems as to what you can and can't do.
Yeah.
And I think you quite fit into that box. Most entrepreneurs don't, so it's not a bad thing necessarily. Now, if someone wanted to get more training from you specifically, do you run training courses that allows people to learn what you've already learned?
Yes. I've got a number of trainings that I do. So I run a deal sourcing, deal packaging course. I run a HMO and LHA training course. I run a rent-to-rent course. All of these are listed on my website, which is arshilahi.com. I'm currently in the process of setting something up called the Elite Property Circle, so keep your eyes out for that. And that is where I'll be working with high net worth individuals such as Premiership footballers, as well as other sports celebrities, should I say, where they've got a lot of cash but they just don't know what to do with it.
Yeah.
So that's something I'm working on.
Well, if you ever need a location, then I'm pretty sure we could make the villa available here in the Med.
So yeah, there's lots of things that I'm doing. It's pretty hard to say because every day is a new challenge, and that's what I like. I like that every day is different. But if you want to know more about me, first thing that I'd suggest, and the one thing that everyone can afford, is to purchase my book, which is Boom, Bust and Back Again, available on Amazon as well as my website. And the one thing I'd just kindly ask is that if you can leave a review. Once you've read it, provided, and be completely honest, whether you liked it or you hated it, I'm open to both parts. And if there's anything that I can else assist with, yeah, feel free to get in touch. I think I'm one of the guys that you can approach about anything. And when I write articles in YPN magazine every month, I get approximately about 200 emails from people who've read the article, either liked it, now got an issue, want to ask questions, and I'm happy to help with that.
Brilliant. Well, Ash, I'd just like to personally thank you for coming on the podcast. As ever in these interviews, it's always educational for me as well as the people listening. And that's why I like to drill down and just get a bit more detail than sort of the throwaway lines that sometimes we use because we understand them. But for other people, I like to drill down and just explain. It's been really enlightening. And if you want to catch up with Ash, then if you go to his website, which is arshilahi.com, and I'll put a link as ever on the podcast page. Ash, thank you very much, and we'll catch up with you soon.
Thank you, Daniel. It's been a pleasure.
Take care.
The Property Coaching and Wealth Creation Podcast, brought to you by property and business coach Daniel Latto. Join the conversation at www.daniellatto.co.uk. Remember to like and subscribe.